Podcast, June 2025 edition, with Phoebe Ryder, Jesse Marin, Lily Correa Magnus, and Jonathan Wong. Hello and welcome to the Jogcast. I'm Phoebe, and it's just me in the studio today. In this month's episode, we interview Professor Joe Zuntz about his research into clustering galaxies for cosmology. Our next JodBite comes from one of this year's PhD cohort, Georgie, as she submits her thesis on molecular line fitting using ALMA. Our live event this month was a great success. It was so lovely to see some of our listeners face to face, meet some old Jogcasters, and show our podcast to new listeners too. This live episode recording will be released as next month's episode, so if you missed it, you can listen along too then. But first, the news. This month's forecast, sunshine and rainbows. One of NASA's newly launched missions has delivered its first rainbow image, along with the first images taken by two of its instruments. The Polarimeter to Unify the Corona and Heliosphere, or PUNCH, mission is aiming to unlock the mysteries of the solar atmosphere and how it streams out as the solar wind. PUNCH was launched back in March this year and consists of four small satellites in a low Earth orbit. These satellites are working together to create a three-dimensional map of the corona and solar wind, and their placement in a sun-synchronous orbit allows them to constantly see the sun, unlike us here in Manchester. The satellites are creating images by measuring the polarisation of light, and the polarisation is revealed via colour coding, resulting in the rainbow image. These images help to confirm that the instruments are in focus and working as expected. Results from PUNCH will help us to better understand the solar wind and how it's connected as a single system between the Earth and the Sun. This knowledge will be able to help make more accurate predictions about the arrival of space weather events, so we can be better prepared for them on Earth, and prepare for their impact on the robotic explorers we have roaming our solar system. On the menu this month, stellar spaghetti. This month, the first optical evidence of a rogue supermassive black hole was found using the Hubble Space Telescope. Black holes of this mass have previously only been found in the centre of galaxies, so finding one that is not gravitationally bound to its galaxy's core, but in fact 2,600 light-years away, has raised many questions about its history. This black hole was found as it wandered close enough to a nearby star for it to stretch and tear it apart, or if you want the technical term, spaghettified, in what's known as an off-centre tidal disruption event, or TDE. This TDE was first detected as a sudden flare by the Zwicky Transient Facility, and then further observations were taken by Hubble, Chandra and the VLA to follow up this rare event in optical, X-ray and radio wavelengths. These events are estimated to occur only once every 30,000 years and are a rare opportunity for us to see the roaming black holes. Next up, we hear from Lily and Jonathan as they chat to Professor Joe Zuntz about his work using photometric data to statistically sample clustering of galaxies. Joe is a professor in cosmology at the University of Edinburgh, but also an ex-Jogcaster between 2013 and 2016. We discuss the issues of this method, such as correctly identifying the redshift these galaxies are in, different cosmological methods such as two-point functions and blinding, a method to reduce human bias when analysing large sets of data.
So welcome everyone. We have Joe Zuntz from Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. He used to be here in Manchester and actually collaborated with the Jodcast. So it's quite exciting to have an old collaborator back. Joe mainly does cosmology and Jonathan is here with me as well, who has also been in prior interviews. And we'll go ahead and ask Joe a load of questions. I think I'll start with some basic overview of what you're currently working on and sort of for our more basic science questions, sort of why it's interesting and why it's important.
Great, yeah, fantastic. Thanks very much for having me. So my big kind of work is with a new survey telescope project called the Vera Rubin Observatory, which you may have had people talking about before. It's a massive project with hundreds, probably thousands of people working on it. So there is a whole class of cosmology that you can do with what's called photometry. So that means you don't measure spectra of galaxies. So you don't know exactly how far away a galaxy is by measuring its redshift. All you know is its colours. So all you get is some vague brightnesses of your galaxy in different colours. So that means you can't do some kinds of measurements. So you can't do anything that relies on knowing exactly where galaxies live in 3D. But you can do a bunch of other kinds of cosmology that involve measurements either in very broad ranges. So if you just want to say, give me all the galaxies that are within 100 million light years or something like that, you can kind of do those very broad brushstroke measurements. And you can look for phenomena that change with time as well. So you can look for things like supernovae that go off. That's the other kind of class of stuff that this kind of survey is very good at looking at, because it's very fast, so you can pick up loads and loads of galaxies all at the same time. So the Vera Rubin Observatory is unfinished construction now. It's in the high Andes, and it has just started a few weeks ago its commissioning phase. So finally, all the bits of the telescope are installed and fingers crossed are working, but they're just testing it all, making sure it all fits together and taking kind of test observations, tuning it, those kinds of things. And in particular, I work on things called weak lensing and galaxy clustering are my main focuses within that.
Cool. It seems like you're joining the party with like DESI and ACT and the Simons Observatory also coming.
There's a whole
online
bunch of things happening all at the same time, yeah, which is really, really nice. Yeah. So the nice thing is ACT has completed its measurements. DESI is kind of halfway through. I think it's got some more data to come, but it's not, you know, analysed everything. But this is no data yet from us, so we're at the beginning. We'll hopefully have our first data release in a few years' time. It takes some time to take the data, some time to process it, some time to analyse it, that kind of stuff. So it'll take a little while yet, but we're at the beginning of that process.
I was wondering if there was any crossover between you and any of the current observatories starting to put out data releases.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other project that I've been working on in the past is called Dark Energy Survey, which is kind of a precursor to the Vera Rubin. It's in that same kind of space of these photometric wide area surveys. So Dark Energy Survey, we surveyed 5,000 square degrees. That's about 1/8 of the sky, and measured a whole bunch of things. And the final data release is going to be really, really soon in the next few weeks. And so that's in that same category. But in terms of sky area as well, there's definitely a program to try and cover the same regions of sky with lots of different surveys. So for example, there's a European Space Agency space telescope called Euclid, which loads of people in the UK are very heavily involved in. And Euclid and Vera Rubin are going to cover a same deep area of sky. They're both going to look super deep in one same area, so they can get kind of crossover between them. And that kind of thing is really useful both for cross-checking, so you can see, do we get the same kind of answers on these things, but also kind of every kind of telescope has its own niche. So for example, telescopes on the ground can see super deep because they are so big. You can make a really, really massive telescope that you can sit on the ground, but they don't get the high resolution because the atmosphere is in the way and blurs out your telescope. So something like Euclid, that's a space telescope, can't ever be as massive as a ground telescope because it's just too big to haul into space, but it has the complementary ability to get super high detail, like really good resolution on all the images it takes. So you can, you know, the combination of those two gets you both high resolution and depth, and that's a really, really valuable combination as well.
Yeah, amazing. It sounds like it's a really exciting time for astronomy.
It's a really
and cosmology.
Cool time. Yeah. We go through these things in waves kind of thing. So the last wave of big surveys finished a few years ago, in photometric surveys finished a few years ago, and the last analyses are coming out now. So the next ones are just gearing up to begin or have just started recently.
Yeah, so I guess just to ask a bit more about the science of these photometric surveys then. So you said you're interested in weak gravitational lensing and galaxy clustering. Could you tell us a bit more about specifically what you're trying to measure and what that will tell us about the universe, or at least what we're hoping it will tell us about the universe?
Yeah, great. So what I'm interested in is structure. So our universe is not the same everywhere. We see bits of the universe with loads and loads of matter in, like galaxies and clusters of galaxies where there's lots of very dense matter in a small area. And we see vast areas that are almost empty, these void regions between the galaxies. And we know it wasn't always like that. We know in the early universe, matter was very uniform across the whole of space. So we know that from other observations that if we look at the early universe, everything was basically the same everywhere. There was very little variation. So the process of going from that nearly homogeneous, uniform universe to our current one with lots of structure in it, lots of variation in it, is what we're trying to understand. And it depends on things like gravity. So we think gravity pulled material together. So we think, you know, a little bit of a tiny excess amount of density in one place is a little seed that gravity then makes grow and pulls in. So you end up with these bigger and bigger and bigger structures in one area. And and it depends on what the universe is made of. So things like dark matter and dark energy affect this clustering process. And it depends on what the universe was like at the beginning. So it's also a kind of peek back into the era shortly after the Big Bang. So that's a kind of trio of really interesting things we really care about and really want to know about. And there's a few ways of measuring that. If you're looking at the early universe, you're looking at the cosmic microwave background, and that's, you mentioned the ACT experiment before. So they've made amazing measurements of that, as have others like Planck and the SPT and the upcoming Simons Observatory. What we do within photometric surveys is to do with galaxy positions. So we are saying that galaxies are kind of tracers of matter. So where there's lots of dark matter and matter overall and gas and other things, there's likely to be a galaxy there. So one thing we do is to say, let's find all the galaxies we can. Let's track them all down. Let's kind of do a big location map of all these galaxies. And then let's say, what are the statistics of that galaxy structure? So we'll measure, hey, loads of galaxies in this area, not many galaxies in that area. We make these kind of maps of density. If you imagine like a contour map of the landscape, you can recognize hills on it and valleys. And it's a bit the same thing. You imagine a hill is a bit like a place with loads of galaxies, and a valley is a bit like an empty region with no galaxies in. And just like those contour maps tell you about geography and the geological processes that formed the landscape, the pattern of hills and valleys, so dense regions with loads of galaxies and empty regions with no galaxies in, tell you about the processes that formed that, tell you about gravity and these structural things. So we're trying to map out first the density of galaxies, and we call that galaxy clustering. So we're trying to figure out where all the galaxies are, how we can quantify their distribution across the sky in a few different ways. So that might involve asking questions like, if we find a galaxy at some position, how many other galaxies will be nearby it on average? How many other galaxies will be a bit further away on average? Different questions like that, and in a quantitative kind of way. So that's one way. And so galaxies are great. Galaxies are interesting things. But if you, to use a kind of landscape analogy, that's a bit like looking at the location of all the post offices on your map to try and figure out the landscape. Post offices are very biased. You only have post offices in a few places where there are loads of people. Right. You don't have them on top of hills and mountains, despite hills and mountains being really, really interesting. So there's things you can't learn from galaxies because they are not kind of perfectly distributed alongside matter. They are biased towards some regions of higher density, typically. One solution we have to that, and one really nice method that we have, is this weak gravitational lensing method. So that means looking at very, very distant galaxies that are way behind all the matter we're actually interested in, and looking at how gravity of stuff between us and them has distorted the pictures we have of them. So when light is affected by gravity, it gets distorted very, very slightly. This is something Einstein predicted and quantified and was measured, you know, first more than 100 years ago now. We've got the first measurements of this. But we're trying to do it with galaxies and in kind of unprecedented numbers across the sky. So we're trying to map out the distortions from gravity of this light. And the really cool thing about this is it lets us bypass worrying about visible matter and see invisible matter as directly as we possibly can. So we're measuring not just where the visible gas and atoms and hydrogen and things are, but where the invisible dark matter is across the universe as well.
Yeah, so I guess when you're measuring all of these galaxies and making these maps over thousands of square degrees of sky, you know, that must be millions, or I guess in the upcoming years, billions of galaxies. So that must be such an immense data task and computational task. So how do you even go from all these tables of millions and billions of numbers and statistics into some final measurement?
Something
to
actually use. Yeah, exactly. Very difficult process. Yeah, absolutely. So there's many different phases. I mean, before you even get to a list of galaxies, you have to do loads of work on your images to say, is there a galaxy here? Is it a star? And that's a very challenging process. You know, if you see a little dot in one of these images, you don't know to start with whether it's a galaxy or a star. You can't tell that. So there's loads of work on that kind of early phase. But once we've kind of done all that, that's where a lot of my work starts. So I'm very interested in the kind of measurement process. So trying to measure all these statistics that we care about to figure out the redshift of our galaxy. So that tells us how far away the galaxy is in a very approximate rough measurement that we can make. Understanding all the problems that come into our data. So if you see a lot of galaxies in one place, That could be because there are actually lots of galaxies there, and you've measured an amazing hot spot in the universe with loads of galaxies. Or it could just be that you looked for a longer time in that direction, so you picked up more light and you saw more galaxies. So you have to be very careful to distinguish those things when it's a very small effect. So if you observe 10% longer in region A than region B, or if the weather was just a little bit better in region C than region D, you know, those things all affect the number of galaxies that you see, and you have to account for that.
You said you don't, or you work with photometric data, so you don't have spectra. How do you actually identify foreground galaxies, and how do you identify what redshift, or like, I guess, the distance to these galaxies?
That's a really good question. It's a very hard question as well. So yeah, so when you have a spectrum of a galaxy, you can measure its redshift pretty much perfectly. You can just tell you exactly where its redshift is. What we have in photometry is very broad wavelength measurements. So we end up, so a spectrum will tell you what is the brightness at 500 nanometers wavelength. A photometric measurement will tell you what is the brightness added up between 500 and 700 nanometers wavelength. So you get this very broad brushstroke measurement, which says the brightness in this whole broad region of wavelength is X, you know. So you don't get anything precise, you get these very, very broad measurements. And there's a whole area called photometric redshifts, which is aiming to figure out, try and backtrack and say, what kinds of galaxies would give us these very broad, rough measurements? And with any one galaxy, that doesn't really work. So if you give one galaxy and say, what is the redshift of this? You'll get a very, very approximate answer that will be, you know, 3 ± 2 or something huge like that, you know, very massive error bars. But if you have enough galaxies and all you care about is the average, is the kind of overall distribution of them, then you can just about do it. So you can say, I've got 1 million galaxies here. Here is the distribution of their brightnesses and their colours and different wavelength ranges. I've got a small sample of spectral galaxies where I know the exact redshifts and I know what I would have seen through my telescope if I'd looked at them, and then I can do a kind of analysis problem to try and figure out what my rough measurements tell me. And sometimes we do that using models of galaxies, and we say, here's our best guess of what a whole class of galaxies spectrum looks like, and we fit with that. Sometimes we use machine learning, so sort of AI type methods where we train some neural network or some machine learning model, and we say, hey, here's a bunch of truth answers where we know the actual answer. Here's a bunch of approximate data. Learn this distribution as best you can. And sometimes we use kind of methods somewhere in the middle to try and do these things. So the big method we're using right now is called self-organizing maps, where you sort of have the data build their own model of the connection between these colors and their true redshift, and you kind of push them into building a model that tells you that connection. That's a really hard problem. Unfortunately, I don't work on it directly, which I'm very, very glad about. But my job involves connecting lots of things together. And one of those things is exactly that redshift problem of saying, you know, hey, before we can measure our galaxy statistics, we need to figure out those redshifts. And when we kind of go off to one piece of code and say, hey, here's the redshift program, go and run that redshift program, and then we'll put the answers together with what we have and bring it all together. So a lot of my work is kind of infrastructure, trying to connect together the statistics measurements, the choosing which galaxies to use, doing the redshift measurements, doing measurements of the errors on those measurements, and pulling it all together into one combined quantity.
Right. In an ideal world, it would be a nice, simple scaling relation, and you'd be like, it's this brightness, therefore it's this redshift.
Yeah, exactly. But really, it's this horribly, what we call non-linear problem. Yeah. So a problem where if you change the input by a little bit, the answer can change completely. Okay. And very often we get answers like, this is either one of the furthest galaxies in our sample, or it's a really nearby close one, and we just can't tell the difference between them, those two. So we have a lot of really ambiguous measurements like that as well, what they call degeneracies. Yeah. So it's a very messy problem, and it's one of the biggest challenges we have for the upcoming data sets, is that there's a kind of double whammy problem in these observations, which is as you collect more and more data, your noise goes down and down and down and down and down because you've got more data, so you can make more and more precise measurements. But that in turn means you have to understand all the inaccuracies in the data better and better and better and better and better. So if you work in industry and you get 10 times as much data, that's brilliant, because now you can answer all your questions 10 times as well. If you work in science, now you have to answer all your questions 10 times better to be able to make best use of all this data that you've obtained, because your noise has gone down, so your systematic errors, so your understanding of the underlying problems in the data has to get better and better and better.
What would the overarching question be? Because I know, at least on my side, it would be like, oh, solving lambda CDM. We have the perfect parameters. like on your side, is it Lambda CDM? Is it dark matter, the nature of dark matter?
Yeah, so a big part of it for us right now is to do with the nature of dark energy. So there's been these recent results about the behaviour of dark energy suggesting it might be changing with time, that the foot is coming off the cosmic accelerator, if you like, slowly. So that's where we all are right now. That's our kind of biggest question right now, is dark energy changing? And lensing and clustering can be a crucial input to that question, where we can figure out how much. So as the universe expands and accelerates, that kind of counteracts gravity a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the dark energy pulls matter apart, just as dark matter gravity pulls it together. Right. So the kind of competition between those two processes is a delicate one, and it tells you, you know, how, and it makes predictions for how much structure, how much matter you should see clustered in different places. So if we can compare those predictions to what we see in reality, then that will be the one. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Wider questions like dark matter are absolutely in there. So one question is, how does dark matter cluster? Is it just gravity, or does it have some kind of other interactions that we haven't been able to detect yet? So people call this the temperature of dark matter sometimes. So sometimes that we ask, is dark matter cold, which is our best guess that it's cold dark matter, or is it warm or hot, and that's to do with how it behaves, so how much clustering it has, or how much resistance to clustering it has. Is that measurement quantity?
Cool.
Yeah, so you talked a lot about quantifying all of these statistics about galaxies, how they cluster, this weak gravitational lensing signal. But in practice, sort of day to day, when you're sitting at your desk, how do you go about choosing some dark energy model, some dark matter model, feeding that into a computer, using things like machine learning? Like, what is that process?
What does that look like? So first of all, we never make predictions in cosmology for the overall picture of everything. So we're not interested in, you know, how many galaxies are there at 10 degrees north, 4 degrees west. You know, we don't make predictions like that in cosmology. What we do is always statistical. So we're always asking questions like, how are galaxies clustering, and how can we quantify that? So the big one that we've been using for many years is what's called two-point statistics for both lensing and for clustering. And what that really says is, if you have one galaxy and a certain distance away, so if you say, for all the galaxies in my big catalogue, let's look 1 degree away from all of those galaxies, and let's count up how many galaxies there are 1 degree away. Or similarly, if we can say, given all my galaxies in my survey, what is the average shape of all the galaxies 1 degree away from that galaxy? So you kind of average over everything. And the idea there is that if galaxies cluster a lot together, then we will see that there are way more galaxies very close to other galaxies. So on average, there will be lots of galaxies near any given galaxy because they're all clustered together. So the typical distance between galaxies is very small. But if gravity is a bit weaker and structure is a bit more diffuse across the universe, then instead we will see a much longer tail to that measurement. So we will see that if you look 2-3 degrees away from a galaxy, that's where you find more other galaxies. And we measure these kind of two-point statistics. Both, what I've just described is what we would call a real space statistic. That's just measuring it, as it sounds, like literally on the sky, distances between galaxies. The other one we call Fourier space, which is a bit more abstract. But if you've ever used a mixer on a stereo and you've changed the high frequency bits and made the bass higher, or the, you know, the high pitch frequencies, the high pitch sound higher, or the low pitch sound higher. So what can people do what DJs do when they're mixing music? One of the things they do is change the signal at different frequencies, the volume at different frequencies. And we have a very similar quantity, which is this thing called Fourier space. So we say, let's break up our distribution of galaxies, our maps of galaxies, into its frequencies. And it turns out that's usually an easier way to understand or to predict what these theories are going to say, because these theories kind of live in Fourier space naturally. It turns out, that's not obvious, but it turns out to be like that. So yeah, we often make these measurements of what these call these. There's an exact equivalent of what I've talked about in real space, and these Fourier space thing as well, where you sort of say, how much do different frequencies correlate? If I find lots of galaxies at a frequency, at a wavelength of 100 megaparsecs, how many will I find at 101 megaparsecs? That kind of question. So yeah, that's the kind of core statistical measurement that we're trying to make. This two-point measurements, and yeah, that's the core one that we use.
When you make these two-point statistics measurements, what answers do you get from them, other than, oh, these are a load of galaxies that are the same shape and they're
what do we actually see from these things? For any of these measurements, we typically get some kind of curve. So we get a bunch of measurements, which say is a kind of function of distance or function of separation between galaxies. We get a different kind of quantity for each of these statistics. And on its own, that's not very, very useful. That's just a number, you know, it doesn't really mean much. What is interesting, what is useful, is we can make theoretical predictions for those numbers. So if you give me your favorite simulation, you give me a theory which says, hey, I've got this new model for dark energy or dark matter, which says it behaves like XYZ, you know, it does some particular way it moves or behaves or clusters or something, then we can use a computational process and kind of work through the predictions of that model for those exact statistics that we can measure on the sky for those two-point statistics. So for any kind of theory of gravity or physics or the dark universe, we can make a theoretical prediction for exactly these two-point quantities that we can measure. And then we can compare the two. So we can say, hey, your theory prediction looks very, very like what we see on the real sky, so your theory might be right. Congratulations, you. Or we can say your theory is totally wrong because it doesn't make any prediction that's remotely like the real data. So occasionally we get things that are that good and we can rule out a theory altogether. More commonly, though, it's a bit more messy. Most theories have what we call free parameters in, so numbers that we just don't know to start with. So, for example, when Isaac Newton was writing down his theory of gravity, he did not know how strong gravity was. He had this number G, which is this, which is the strength of gravity. And they had to do experiments to kind of figure out what that value G was. Very, very similarly, we have a bunch of parameters in our models, and one might be the amount of dark matter in the universe, the amount of dark energy in the universe, the Hubble parameter, which is how fast the universe is expanding. All these numbers for a given model are not known. They're all kind of free numbers where lots of different numbers might fit the data. And we have a statistical process then, once we've made these measurements, to compare all the possible numbers that could be true to the actual measured data. And that's a very interesting statistical problem called inference, where you're trying to sample over any possible numbers that you could have for these parameters whilst kind of homing in on the ones that are good fits to the data. Because if I say, sorry, Lily, your theory doesn't fit the data with parameter X being 5,000, you can just say, well, did you try 2,000? Right. And then I might be right. So the idea here is to home in on the ones that fit the data as well as possible and see how well they fit the data. Mm. Because if there's no parameters that fit the data, it's a terrible model. It's not going to work. And if there's very specific parameters that fit the data, that could work. And that's really useful because we can cross-check with another experiment of a different kind. So we can say, well, my lensing experiment says your parameter is 5,000. But the CMB says it's 2,000, so they disagree,
right?
And they don't agree
so
with
like
each
the,
other.
So like the Hubble tension.
Exactly. So there's this whole world of tensions recently. So we've had a whole bunch of measurements where, in our kind of basic models of the universe, the two different experiments give different numbers for the best fitting parameters. And the big kind of classic example of this is the Hubble tension, where measurements of the nearby universe found the number 72 for this Hubble parameter, telling us how fast the universe is expanding. Whereas measurements of the early universe in the CMB and other kinds as well give you the number 66 or 68 in some particular units. And this either means that one or both of those experiments was wrong, which is entirely possible, or it can mean the underlying model you have that says they should be the same is just not correct. Like if your model's wrong for the universe, the numbers in it don't really mean anything. You know, they're not particularly meaningful if your kind of whole picture of the universe is wrong. And there's a few of these in cosmology. So the Hubble one is the big one. The most recent results from the DESI survey is really exciting because they are sort of, you can think of those as a tension within our baseline Lambda CDM model of the universe. They are saying just a constant dark energy is not a good fit to the data, according to this. The other big one until recently was something called the S8 tension. Right. So this is particular to lensing, really, where several surveys were finding a lower measurement of a particular parameter called S8, which quantified clustering in the universe. So exactly how much you found big clusters of galaxies versus a big sort of large empty areas, so that you can kind of quantify that. If people at home know standard deviation or variance from their statistics classes at school, they may remember that. It's essentially the variance of the matter distribution in the universe. It's one way of quantifying that. And CMB measurements were finding a higher number than things like lensing and clustering were detecting. We've had some fairly recent results from a survey called KIDS, the Kilo Degree Survey, which my friend Catherine works very, very hard on, so I like to blame her because she's a good friend of mine. New measurements from them are suggesting that this is probably all a big mistake, and actually this is all a misunderstanding of exactly that redshift problem we talked about before. So redshifts are really hard to measure, and what this is suggesting is that was underestimated. So we thought we had a handle on the errors on those redshifts, but actually that error was bigger than we thought it was. And the methods we had to quantify that were not quite right and not working. So it looks like that one's kicked to the curb now.
Is it official? Is everybody agreed, like,
happy with it? No. So there were three big surveys in the last generation who did these lensing measurements, and they're called KIDS, which my friend Catherine, she was your old lecturer, wasn't she?
Yeah, she
worked
was.
On, and my friend Catherine worked on. There was Dark Energy Survey, which I worked on. There's one called Hyper Supreme CAM, which is a joint US-Japan project. And they all found sort of consistent results. KIDS was always the lowest, DES was always the highest, and HSC was somewhere in the middle. And now KIDS just radically reanalyzed their results and found a much, much higher measurement, much more in agreement with the CMB. So now HSC is the kind of most extreme outlier and still has a kind of mild disagreement and a mild tension, as we're calling it, but certainly less compelling than the old KIDS one that is now suspected to be incorrect. We should be really careful here, just because, you know, one analysis says, you know, that there's nothing exciting happening, doesn't mean that's right. You know, you can, you know, it could be that the new results are wrong and the old results were right. That's always possible too, and we should be careful with that. But yeah, it's a bit of a sad end to an interesting tension. Yeah.
I guess there's also a really kind of human aspect to all these measurements as well, right? You know, if you're searching for all these numbers that fit these models, you know, other surveys have measured particular numbers, how do you ensure that there's not some sort of human bias when you're looking at the new data that you have?
Yeah, it's a very big worry. I mean, and we're not talking about people deliberately doing anything,
yeah,
of course, you know, but when you have a result that you're expecting, you often interpret anything else as being some kind of problem. And if you keep solving problems just until you get the result you expect, and then you stop, you will always get the result you expect, because there are dozens of problems to solve, and each one of them will change the results a little bit. And if you just keep waiting until you get the result you expect and then stop, then you'll basically always end up in the same result that you expect. And sometimes people want to agree with other results. You know, sometimes you're thinking, like, if I don't get the same result as this CMB experiment, I must have made a mistake, because they're bound to be right. They work really hard. Sometimes they're more complicated. Sometimes they're just it's theoretical expectations. Sometimes you're thinking, well, everyone knows this parameter has to be bigger than 0.4 because otherwise something theoretical doesn't happen. So there's a methodology that we've kind of developed, which is now quite heavily used in cosmology, called blinding, where you try and avoid this problem altogether by deliberately hiding information from yourselves. So what we've been doing in all these surveys is we work hard to fix all the problems we can find without looking at our results, without looking at the final results that we might be biased about. So we can look at other results. We can look at parameters that we don't really care about, you know, parameters that don't really mean much or are just parameterizing errors in the data, that kind of stuff that we don't have a kind of strong expectation for. We're allowed to see what they are and mess about with those and see what's going on. But we try and solve all the problems without looking at the kind of core primary answer of the data. And then only once we've fixed all the analysis process as far as we possibly can, do we finally look at what the real data is telling us and do what we call unblinding process, or opening the box, they call it sometimes, to see what the true answer is. And that's a really exciting moment,
yeah,
because your part of you is always terrified that there's going to be complete nonsense,
yeah,
you know, that you've done all this analysis and actually it's just completely incorrect and there is results are complete garbage, which could happen. We make all kinds of mistakes, but mostly it's a way of ensuring exactly that we don't
yeah,
just always get the result we're expecting.
Yeah, just ensuring that objectivity and you're being as thorough as you can in the scientific
exactly method. Yeah, we're trying to avoid our own biases,
yeah,
and it's a strange process. There's different ways of doing it. It's actually quite hard to blind yourself effectively,
yeah,
while still giving yourself access to the information you need to have,
yeah,
because there's things you do want to look at. For example, I talked before about the data measurements we make of these two-point things we're measuring measurements on a curve. You don't want to make the measurements visible to yourselves, because that might bias you, especially if you've got the lines going through them. You can see, oh, it doesn't fit the line, must be wrong, oh no. But equally, we do need to look at those to see if they should be smooth, but that's not ambiguous. They should definitely be smooth curves, these things. We do want to see that kind of thing. And so it's quite hard to find,
yeah, yeah,
methods that sort of blind you to the to the things you want to be blinded to, but not to all the other stuff that you,
yeah,
do want to look at and try and understand. And there's different ways of doing it. For the Dark Energy Survey, for example, we had a whole project where we multiplied all our measurements by like a secret number that nobody knew that kind of generated semi-randomly or from,
yeah,
this kind of code phrase that we used. So we didn't know if the results were going to go up or down later on, or how much they were going to change by later on. Unfortunately, we actually made a mistake in Dark Energy Survey, which is that we had a whole process for blinding by multiplying by a secret number. And we also had a whole process of calibration, which figures out and corrects for multiplications by sort of known problems. And unfortunately, we got those two processes in the wrong order. So we carefully blinded our data, and then our calibration process dutifully unblinded it for us and corrected all that blinding process. Fortunately, we didn't realise that till afterwards.
Right, yeah. So you there was nothing to change.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we thought we were blind, even though we weren't. So we didn't look at the results because we knew they didn't mean anything to us.
Right.
But actually, they were. If we had looked at them, they would have been correct.
Yeah.
So it's you have to be very. So you can see all those weird pitfalls you get with these things to do this blinding stuff. It's very, very challenging.
And there's no standard across.
No, there isn't. And it varies a lot by the project you're doing. And some methods that are suitable for one area just aren't going to be suitable for other areas as well. So it's not like you can do something totally generic. Unfortunately, no. There's no one right answer. There's lots of best approaches. And the main thing you're trying to do is just stop people feeling like they can do it. So if you could just trick everyone, which we sort of did by accident, but if you could just trick everyone, I propose just telling everyone the data were blinded and lying to them and then revealing that, it was the real data all along. But no one went along with that plan. So, but that would have worked very well, I think,
So I guess from all of these surveys, all of these blinding techniques, measurement techniques, analysis techniques, putting that all together, you must be learning a lot for the future and the next few years of measurements and telescopes, Rubin Observatory, for example. So what are your hopes for the next few years?
It's a really exciting time. You know, like I said, the calibration is just starting for these observables. So I'm hoping that in about 3 years' time, 2-3 years' time, we will have the best measurements we've ever made of how the universe is lensed by gravity, so how gravity is bending light in cosmologically, of the evolution of cosmic structure, you know, through time, how it's varying across time. And I think that could, first of all, resolve some of these tensions and really tell us, you know, are these tensions real? Are they not? I think they can tell us, is the universe acceleration changing? Is it getting weaker with time? I would really like them to really pin down dark matter properties. I think they can potentially do some of those, not everything, but some of the properties of dark matter can really be pinned down by that. And kind of more methodologically, my big goal is to make all this very repeatable. So, cosmology is really hard. My goal from what I'm doing personally is to make it so that we can redo things much more easily than we ever could before. So in the past, it's always been, oh God, the slog to get to this point has been so hard. I can't envision doing it again. You know, the analysis is such a big job involving so many different people that doing it again is incredibly difficult. So my kind of personal goal is to say, let's build our whole analysis in such a way that we can just redo it straight away by typing one thing on a admittedly big supercomputer. It's not like anyone can do this at home on their laptop, but at least, you know, that we can rerun this process as cleanly as possible from start to finish and just see it all happen. And my hope is that will let us do things like compare to loads of different kinds of new models of dark energy, of how matter behaves on small scales, all those kind of things, and that will let us explore a much wider space of possibilities that we can see.
I think reproducibility is one of those things that everybody strives for and very few people actually achieve.
It's much harder than it looks, isn't it? And it requires a lot of... I'm quite a bossy person, naturally, so and a bit of a control freak, and that's quite good for reproducibility, that if you can be like, sort of insist that people do things in a way that makes it possible and say, no, I know you're not used to working like this, but now we're doing everything in this exact one way. I don't care if you've written the best computer program in the world for analysing galaxies, you have to plug it into this system, otherwise we're not going to run it, and that requires a little bit of discipline and some flexibility. You know, you have to there are always edges that you're going to end up, you know, having to play around with. But that's my goal.
Thank you Joe. Thank you Jonathan.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really nice to be back here.
And on to the job bite. As JBCA's final year PhD students submit their thesis and prepare to defend, we are putting together a series to celebrate their accomplishments and get the chance to chat to them about their research. In this Jod Bite, Jessie talks to Georgie about her work in molecular line fitting using ALMA.
Hi everyone, this is Jessie, and joining me today is Georgie Stroud.
Hello.
Welcome, Georgie.
I haven't done the Jodcast before, but it's nice to finally see what goes on in here.
It's good to have you, and I promise we don't bite. Although this is the Jod Bite.
Yeah.
So, Georgie, you are a final year PhD student. You're part of the Star Formation group.
Yes, I am.
And you're also already owner of a beautiful and adorable cat.
Yes, like most cat owners, I have the most beautiful and adorable cat in the world.
I've seen it, folks. It is true. And so, Georgie, could you please just tell us what you do here at JBCA?
Yeah, sure. So, as Jessie said, I'm a final year PhD student. So mostly I'm an observationalist, which means instead of looking at simulations or fake galaxies and stars and all of that stuff, like Jesse does, I look at real galaxies, real stars. But that also means that I have to deal with things like the atmosphere getting in the way and noise and all the other annoying stuff that comes along with reality. So at the moment, what I'm doing is working on a set of stars that are baby stars. They've only just formed. And I'm looking at how they emit light, what colour they are, and what that can tell us about the conditions that they're in.
And so I know you do molecular line fizzing.
I do.
That sounds terrifying.
Indeed. It's a specific form of torture. So molecular lines are very specific transitions. So people listening might know that sulfur has a very particular yellow colour, like an old sodium lamp or sulfur lamp. There is a very particular wavelength of light which that produces. So other elements and molecules and compounds also have very particular wavelengths of light which they emit at. These are all over the spectrum. And what I do is basically looking at those lines, those specific frequencies where different molecules emit light. And I can tell from the shape of that line and the strength of it, and by comparing it with other lines from the same molecule or from different molecules, I can tell all sorts of things about how the gas emitting that line is moving and what temperature it is and how dense it is. So there's a lot of stuff that you can tell from just looking at these lines. They're really interesting.
And so what molecules are you looking at in particular?
At the moment, I'm focusing on methyl cyanide, which is CH3CN. So it's composed of carbon, hydrogen, and a nitrogen atom. And it's useful because it has a lot of lines very close together to each other. So I can look in one observation at all sorts of different lines of this one molecule, and that can tell me a lot about its temperature and its density.
And so you mentioned atmosphere and other things getting in the way, and so I'm guessing it's quite difficult to go just from the raw light that you're getting from the star into like finding those lines. And so can you kind of tell us what the process is?
Yeah, sure. So the raw data, which comes out of something called an interferometer, which is a big set of lots of different radio dishes. The one that I've been using is called ALMA, and it's, in my opinion, it's the best in the world. It's the best of the world at what it does, but I'm fond of it, obviously. But ALMA has taken these observations, so it's pointed at its dishes at these sort of 25 different little stars. What I do with the readings that ALMA has taken is I look through them and I flag, first of all, anything that is problematic. So, for example, if a satellite has gone past the sky at just the right angle at just the right time, that will be picked up by ALMA. And obviously that'll mess up the data that I'm trying to look at the star, not at the satellite. So things like that are easy to identify and remove. And ALMA has a lot of software that actually goes through and does most of this stuff automatically. Mostly what I do is look at the data, look at the spectral lines, and try and work out what is genuine emission, what is noise. You always get noise. You always get some kind of, you know, atmosphere stuff, water vapor. It's ALMA's out in the Atacama Desert, where it's one of the driest and highest places on Earth. But there are still clouds. There is still stuff that gets in the way. So I need to look out for all of that. I need to look out for various interferometric effects. So that is stuff that crops up because we're using an interferometer. So instead of looking in a mirror, imagine you're looking at a curved mirror, but most of it is blacked out. There's only a few tiny spots, and you're trying to piece together what's on the other side of that, what's being reflected in that mirror from what you can see in these few tiny spots. And there's going to be some holes, there's going to be some things which don't quite add up. So I need to look out for that. It's complicated, but you get some amazing results in the end.
That sounds like a very intense and tedious process. Once you've got the data cleaned and you have your emission lines, how easy is the fitting?
That's the million-dollar question. Why I'm doing my PhD in this fitting is that they are very hard to fit. So the fitting software that I'm using isn't just matching up a Gaussian line profile, so a sort of bell curve, to what we can see. That would be not easy, but fairly trivial. The software that I'm using is instead building a molecular model. So I tell the software, okay, I've got this gas, I've got methyl cyanide, I want it at this temperature, at this density, at this source size, so how much of it is concentrated in which area. And that software then simulates what would happen if that particular gas, methyl cyanide, was at that density, at that temperature, with that sort of turbulence velocity, and produces from that, it produces a model of what emission that would produce. All of these things aren't just simple mathematical models, they're very complicated chemical models. And that means there are lots of restrictions about what you can do and what you can't do. You can't, for example, have gas that's at 10,000 Kelvin, because in the regions that I'm looking at, that's a very, very hot, very unreasonable temperature. The gas that I'm looking at is more around 300 Kelvin, maybe 1,000 Kelvin maximum, which is quite warm in terms of the interstellar medium, but that's because the regions I'm looking at are very near forming stars, which produce a lot of heat. So I need to think about the environmental conditions of the gas that I'm looking at, and what temperatures are reasonable, what sort of densities are reasonable, what kind of ranges in these parameters is physically possible, and take that into account when I'm running my fits. The other thing that complicates these fits is that often you don't just need one component. So you don't just need one temperature and one density. There are multiple things happening at different temperatures and different densities. For example, in a forming star, you have the very hot central star, and then around that, you have the material that is accreting onto the star. So that stuff will be slightly cooler than the actual central star. It will be slightly less dense because it's not a star, it's the stuff around it. And it will likely be larger. So in the case where those two things are both happening, I have to try and separate out what contribution is coming from which area and build my chemical models so that they take into account the sort of actual physical behavior of what's going on. That can be quite complicated, especially as that two-component model I just described is an oversimplification.
Okay, very quickly, could you name all the components that you're trying to fit at the same time?
So I'm trying to fit vibrationally excited methyl cyanide, two components of non-vibrationally excited but rotationally excited methyl cyanide, which I call the fixed component and the free component. I'm fitting a 13C isotopologue as well, so methyl cyanide, but one of the atoms in that molecule is slightly heavier. I'm also fitting a whole bunch of other stuff just because it gets in the way, it's blended. So I'm fitting methanol, I'm fitting NH3, ammonia, I'm fitting all sorts of stuff. I can't remember all of them, to be honest. But there's a lot going into what I do, and I have to make sure to tweak each part of it very carefully to make sure it's all on the right track.
Oh, okay. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And so you were talking about vibrationally excited and rotationally excited. Could you just kind of briefly tell us what that means?
Right. So molecular excitation is a full chapter of my thesis. I won't bore you with it too much, but basically, when you have atoms, they can vibrate in certain ways. When you have molecules, when those atoms join together, they can vibrate in different ways, and they can get excited in many different ways. It's like if you have a skipping rope, you can either swing it side to side and produce a wave, or you can swing it up and down and produce a wave. Those are two different ways of exciting of moving that rope so that it moves, it transfers energy from one end to the other. But those two modes are quite different. Shaking it up and down, shaking it side to side, produce different effects. So molecules are a bit like that. There are several different ways which they can move in order to transmit energy. One of those ways is vibrational, and that's a bit like, imagine you have two heavy balls connected by a spring, and they're floating in midair. So if you pull that spring apart, I'm making the hand gestures even though you guys can't see me. If you pull those balls apart on that spring and let them go, they will move backwards and forwards, and they will move towards each other and then away from each other, then towards each other, then away from each other, and they'll keep moving like that. That is almost exactly what the atoms in a molecule are doing when they're vibrationally excited. And that motion, that energy, produces photons through complicated stuff, but that energy makes it glow at a very specific frequency, which I can see.
And I'm guessing rotationally excited is when things are spinning around.
Rotationally excited is indeed when things are spinning around. So those balls on the spring are also spinning around and also connected to a bunch of other balls on springs, because it's not just a diatomic molecule, it's polyatomic. And the whole thing is being blasted by radiation.
I see. And so is the radiation what excites the molecule in the first place?
Yeah, so you have the radiation from this central young star. That's what heats everything up, what gets everything going. That, as well as things crashing into each other, you have external sources of energy as well. So things like a nearby supernova might come along and push some of the gas together and excite it that way. There are all sorts of mechanisms. But the important thing is the gas is excited. It is at some higher temperature and it is cooling down, which is what releases the photons. It's de-exciting.
Oh, okay. And so you mentioned ALMA, and I'm sure our audience already knows a lot about ALMA. We talk about it a lot. Can we not do this with a single dish as well? Or does it have to be done with an interferometer?
We can do this with a single dish. So what you really need in order to do what I'm doing is good spectral resolution. So what ALMA gives is very good spatial resolution and very good spectral resolution. An interferometer gives us a much better picture of what's going on, especially on the very small scales, which is what I'm looking at, because these forming stars, individual stars, are quite small. We need to really get down to those small scales and make sure that we're not mixing up emission from larger scales in with the emission from smaller scales, and sort of blurring everything out.
Okay, I see. Outside of this very exciting research that you're doing, are there any other things that you're able to make time for in your very busy schedule?
Yes, many things. So I do a lot of gaming, actually. I've been playing Stardew Valley again recently, because the latest update has just come out on Switch, so I'm replaying the whole thing, as you do. Obviously, I have my cat, who I take care of, and who requires a lot of my attention, because, you know, she's queen of all she surveys. I do all sorts of other things. I like reading. At my peak, I was reading over 100 books a year.
Wow.
But I've slowed down a bit since I've done my PhD, but I'm still over a book a week, I think.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You heard it here, people. Astronomers are people too, and we have fun.
Yeah, I don't even read about space, because that's work.
Well, Georgie, it's been fantastic having you here. Thank you so much.
Of course, it's been my pleasure.
As ever, it's lovely to hear from our listeners, and we've had some feedback this month. On Instagram, we have had several comments about our recent episode with Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell. Owen Johnson says, so cool. Valerie Marin Bangkok loved the episode, and Jodrell Banks says, this is exciting. Also, keep your eyes peeled next month for our next listener feedback form. This survey will only take about 5 minutes, and we would love to hear what you enjoy from the show and any suggestions you may have about what we could do in the future. And remember, if you do want to get in touch, you can do so via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, or send us post. Links and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net. Thank you to Joe Zuntz and Georgie Stroud for the interviews. The audio editors were Jamie Inslee, Jordan Norris, and Louisa Mason. The show editor was Louisa Mason. The producers were Lily Correa Magnus and Tobias Russell. Until next time, jod on.